Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The day today is March 10th, 2019, and this is episode 172. I'm the host, Mark Ames, coming to you from Telescope Audio Studios here in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And I'm on the line with the Warner, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan, in Buenos Aires. How's it going, John?
It's good. It's cooled off in Buenos Aires, and it really is, you know, good winds right now. And when this city is, it's very humid here, sort of like New York. So when it gets hot at all, it's quickly unbearable. But when it cools down, it's beautiful. And we're on the top of this building, and the clouds go by, and the parrots go by. It's fantastic. But we had bad luck because we missed Carnival. We wanted to see it, you know, the whole Mardi Gras carnival thing. But being a literalist, I kept saying, well, it's on Tuesday, Mardi, you know, Tuesday. And Catherine said, no, I think it's on Monday. And I said, Monday, that's ridiculous. So we wake up on Tuesday morning ready to go out, and it turns out it was on Monday. So we missed the whole thing. But we looked into it after this, and it turns out Carnival in Buenos Aires has an interesting history, which, and I'm making a guess here, and I may be wrong. I don't mean to be offensive with this guess, so if I'm wrong, by all means, tell me. But Buenos Aires has an interesting sort of ethnic consciousness of itself. It was originally a mixed-race city with a large African population. And in fact, when we were in the museum with Gabriel last week, we saw something from the long and bloody Argentine Civil Wars featuring an embroidered coverlet showing the freed slaves of Buenos Aires greeting the leader of the provinces who had freed them from their urban slave masters, because that's the big conflict, the Buenos Aires versus the provinces. And then a lot of people, black people in Buenos Aires, say we were erased from the city's history by this huge wave of European immigration, which was encouraged by the people who ran Argentina, mostly from Southern Europe, especially Italy, but also Germany and Central Europe. So now people say, Argentina has, and I can't verify this because I haven't been out to the provinces, but people who've lived here all their lives say Argentina has a kind of racial divide between Buenos Aires, which sees itself as white, and the provinces, which see themselves as mixed race. And I think that has, again, guessing, I think that has something to do with the history of Carnival in this city, because you never associate Carnival with Buenos Aires so much, or at least I never did. You associate it with Brazil in particular, mm-hmm. and Colombia and places north.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had no idea, actually, that they even had a
carnival. Good reason. Yeah, they didn't. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. It was reinstituted, we found out, 1997.
Ah.
And you can't help suspecting that that was when all this black, Brazilian, proletarian stuff proletarian one-day decadence became cool again.
Right.
And that's when the city went for it again. But until that time, I think Buenos Aires, at least people say, wanted to see itself as a European and implicitly a white city. So they were not too thrilled about the idea of joining the Brazilians in that, you know, in that rowdy behavior. But even in Brazil, as we're seeing, Carnival is under attack. I mean, that's one thing you would never expect. You probably saw that Bolsonaro thing, right?
The tweet, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where he said, "What's a golden shower?" Yeah. In what we might call a disingenuous manner.
Yeah.
and accompanied it by a video of a golden shower taking place in the middle of a carnival parade. And when you reflect that Bolsonaro's big base mm-hmm. is the newly prudish evangelical demographic of Brazil, you can see that not just here pre-1997, but in Brazil right now, it's clear that Carnival has been weaponized for political purposes.
Yeah, it's good. It's something you would never think about or imagine possible, but there you have it. I saw also there were, I think from in Brazil, there are like different kind of memes going around now because of that tweet. It's like, it'll show kind of two screenshots, and one is, I mean, even one of them had Abraham Lincoln, but in Portuguese, you know, 70, something eloquent, and then Bolsonaro, what is a golden shower? I don't know how it's going to work there, but if it works at all, like Trump here, or like Berlusconi, you know, as Anibale kind of explained to us, you know, sick burns don't work. No. They just slide off the Teflon. Yeah.
But if Carnival is, and I'm just guessing, if Carnival is a really popular, genuine people's holiday, then this might not be one of his most popular moves. Generally, people like their holidays, and they're not too thrilled when you start messing with that. It's a day off. It's an excuse to get legitimately drunk. People resent having that messed with.
Yeah. So, real quickly, what about, I have to close this out because your tooth problems have been an integral part of your little war campaign in Latin America. And it finally seems to have resolved, but in a pretty horrific way.
They pulled the molar. Yeah, okay. And they pulled the molar. And
the molar said, that had a root canal work done on it before. Is that right?
Well, they left a little bow tie of dental string at the base of the root of the tooth, which my body decided was an invader.
An invader. Am I wrong?
It is.
Yeah, okay.
No, it is. Yeah, the body does not tolerate foreign material inside it. And this is between the tooth and the jawbone. And there's really no room for dental floss right in there.
No. I saw the photo. That just made me just squirm. That somebody, one of the, and you don't know which dentist it would be.
I've had a lot of dentists.
Good. Sorry, that sounded like a comedy routine. I've had a lot of dentists.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I have. I mean, it's, and the thing is, I don't know why. Maybe because we travel in really conservative countries. Maybe because medical personnel just don't like my face. But I get told ibuprofen should do it. And I was told that twice when the abscess flared up. And one time this guy is looking, I can see him looking at the x-ray in front of one of those light panels they have in dental offices. And he says, yeah, you've got an abscess there. We'll give you some amoxicillin. That should bring it down. Ibuprofen should do for the pain. And then when they pulled the tooth out, it was ibuprofen should do for the pain.
Oh my God.
I don't know what it is about me, but this is why I have a hard time with those opioid epidemic stories. Yeah. Like, not around here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just imagining the Civil War, you know. Okay, we're going to have to take the leg off. Ibuprofen should help with the pain on this.
Reduce the swelling. And I was starting to resign myself to it, thinking, oh, well, maybe, you know, things have changed. And then someone on Patreon who heard the account on the last show said, wow, when I had one of those abscesses under a root canal, the dentist just gave me like a bottle of oxycodone, a whole bottle of it. Not even OxyContin, the time-release thing, you know, actual oxycodone.
Wow.
So I don't know. It gives new hope to my persecution mania.
But I think it is also the times. It's just kind of coming out, as I've said, in the last two years, the whole opioid epidemic, and it's probably made doctors more nervous, although I don't know why that would reach Buenos Aires or Montevideo or whatever.
Does
seem to be
Gabriel
a conspiracy.
Gabriel Arte, RWN guest who grew up here, it's always been like that. Mm. I also ran out of antidepressants. I'm not going to lie about antidepressants. I use antidepressants, and they changed my life. And we ran out of them, and suddenly, as happens, I found that the world was bone grating on bone feeling I remembered very well. So we had to go around looking for them, which is a long story, but we did get them eventually. And then two pharmacies were very, very reluctant to fill that prescription.
Wow.
Until I finally had to try to yell in Spanish. And it's a good way to practice your Spanish, yelling at pharmacists. I mean, naturally, when I yell, it's totally fake. And it doesn't work in some places. Like, as I've said before, when I tried to yell in Saudi Arabia at my students, they not only found it amusing, but I caught one of them bringing in his friends, saying something purposely outrageous, like, "Teacher, I go drive today." And I said, "No, you can't." And he looked at his friend and said, "See, that's hilarious when he tries to yell." But there are other places like Anglo-Canada where I am an effective yeller. It depends on local standards.
Yeah. You've talked about Stalinist pharmacies. Is that you've been facing a lot of these Stalinist pharmacies lately? But yeah. So anyway, I should wrap up. I mean,
first you've got to wrap up.
I know. And first of all, thanks. I actually got some nice notes and stuff from some of our subscribers about my kid and this wretched, horrible croup cough that he had, and these swollen adenoids and tonsils and stuff, and. So yeah, we had the surgery on Wednesday, and we didn't want him to get sick again and go through like what we went through a week ago. 2 weeks ago, where he started suffocating in front of me. So we were able to schedule the surgery for a week later, and we just kept him home from school, and everybody drove everybody crazy for that week. But there was no way we were going to let him get sick. And I, you know, as every day kind of counted down, and they were long days, started getting more and more nervous thinking about, you know, putting two things. First of all, putting a 3-year-old child under general anesthetic really makes you scared. That's A. And then B, thinking about my kid who's pretty sensory, although I'm a lot better now, but thinking about him.
Well, the way you described, I don't know if you want to do this, but the way you described taking him in there and he sees what's going on and then they put the mask on.
Oh, well, yeah, that's what I was going to.
Oh,
say,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of bringing him in and that he would allow a gas mask on him, it just seemed impossible. In fact, they wanted to just put sort of kind of a steam oxygen and steam mask or something for when he had that croup cough and he nearly suffocated when he was in ER a few weeks ago. They wanted to have the gas mask just kind of near him, and he screamed and shrieked and freaked out, and we couldn't do that. And so before we brought him in for the surgery, we told the anesthesiologist, you might just have to give him a shot beforehand because there's no way you're going to get a gas mask on him. And there's going to be screaming. And we looked into it.
So he'd be more afraid of a gas mask than a shot because some kids are terrified of shots.
Yes, but the shot you could hold him and it's fast is what we were thinking. Right. He'll scream either way, but the gas mask, we were told, needs at least 30 seconds.
Right.
And it just looks scary. You know, the shot, you kind of come up from behind, I think, just put it in. So we thought. And we brought him to the hospital. You know, we had to get up early. We had to be at the hospital at 7:30. He didn't want to get up early. We had to, you know, fight to dress him. We brought him in, and he was actually more or less pretty good. He brought his bear. He loves, the only kind of closest thing to a teddy bear he has is Mishka from, I don't know if you know, now that you have Netflix, you can watch it. Masha and the Bear, Masha and Medved.
Okay.
It's actually a really good cartoon. It's a Russian cartoon. It's Russians actually have been, since the Soviet times, they've been really good at cartoons. And this one is about the closest thing to a Looney Tunes.
They love that in Italy too, Masha and the Bear.
Oh, they do? Okay, yeah. Because
every child grows up seeing that, I think.
Well, so the Times, you know, UK, the British, the Times newspaper, their sort of paper of record, put out a big article a couple months ago saying that experts had decoded Masha and the Bear and decided it's Russian active measures to, and I'm not joking, like very serious, it's Russian active measures to poison generations.
They keep topping themselves.
I know
we're digressing, but it's just too astonishing. Like the Daily Mirror, one of the biggest tabloids in Britain, I think maybe the second biggest, had a big story on aviation experts says flight MH370, the one that went into the Indian Ocean and vanished, was sabotaged by the Russians.
Right.
And there's no proof of this whatsoever.
No.
It's just that it actually said there could have been a Russian on board messing with the avionics. And it's like, if there's a Russian on board, it's like bugs in the gremlin.
Yep.
The Russian's natural instinct, its purpose in life, is to start taking rivets out of the wings.
Yeah, that funny enough, that conspiracy was also aired, that same one was aired in a slightly different form in New York Magazine a couple of years ago. So, wow. Like a much more respectable magazine, and there was a big article, and it had caveats, the usual caveats. Of course, there is no proof. As I think as Chris Moore says in, it was either the Day-to-Day or Brass Eyes, there's no evidence yet, but it is scientific fact. You know, that's pretty much it. Anyway, so we brought Sam in, and then again, when we were there waiting in the waiting room, and you know, you just got a pit in your stomach thinking, how the hell is my kid going to have surgery? How are we going to get the gas mask on him? Is he going to wake up? You know, is he going to be screaming? Like, it's just battery acid in the stomach. And we told the anesthesiologist again the same thing, what we thought. And we had to wait, you know, over an hour sitting there stewing. And then the anesthesiologist comes up and he approaches Sam and he has a little gas mask on him. And he sees Sam with his little Mishka, the bear doll. And he puts the gas mask, he kind of shows it to Sam. He's like, hey, do you want to, you know, we've got to help Mishka because Mishka has to have Mishka's mouth hurts. And Sam's like, yeah. And Sam was very friendly to the anesthesiologist and listened to him. And
that seems relatively consumer friendly for a doctor. A lot of them don't have the old social skills.
Yes. And then Sam started kind of playing with Mishka and putting the gas mask on Mishka's mouth. And so they did that for a couple minutes. And then he said, okay, well, let's go to the let's go to the room. I don't think he called it the operating room. And we went in there. And I know I vaguely kind of remember this from my own surgery. And for Sam, it must have been times a thousand. But things happen so fast and it's so surreal when you walk into an operating room and there's an empty bed waiting for you. And there's all these really busy people and there's doctors and there's these instruments and there are nurses and they're all saying, hi, you know, and kind of trying to make you feel good, which makes you feel 100 times more nervous. And things are almost like in a spin. And I could see Sam was kind of almost in a spin. And I was then supposed to sit down with Sam and then bear hug him to hold his arms like to his side. And so I sat down, bear hugged him and started singing a song to him. And the anesthesiologist came right behind both of us and jammed the gas mask over him, over his face. And he started whimpering and crying a bit and I had to hold him. And then he just fell dead in my arms, like dead limp.
Well, that doesn't sound as bad as it could have been.
No, it was just traumatic for me. Yeah, he didn't really have too much time to panic, but I have to say it was pretty traumatic for me, like sitting there feeling your own kid going dead limp. And then you put him on the, you know, operating table and he's just, I mean, it's like he's dead. You know, my wife was just bawling her head off looking at it because it's like that, you know, he's not, but you feel like you've tricked your kid. But of course you did it for the right reasons. I mean, he does have these completely swollen adenoids and tonsils. And surgery lasted an hour. It brought him out. He started waking up crying. He had IVs in him. He was begging us to take them out. He had to keep them in for 2 hours. He did all right. That day he was just groggy from the surgery and kind of confused and kind of feeling like, why did you do that to me?
Yeah.
And that made me feel pretty horrible. And, but then by the next day, everything was back to mostly normal.
I mean, I don't remember that stage, but I would guess that at that stage, the slate gets wiped completely clean when you sleep. And the next day is a new era, right?
Yeah. I think so, pretty much. And I think, you know, the reality is with kids, I mean, it takes a lot to have your kid. My sense is, for nearly all kids, it takes a lot for a kid to really actually genuinely stop trusting a parent. Parents can do a lot of actual genuine malicious abuse and they'll still trust them. It's like, I think it's how we're hardwired. Yeah. And, you know, And so, I felt sort of mixed emotion. Like you feel pretty damn terrible about yourself, but you know it's got to be done. And then you just try to go through your head all the things that, you know, the things that all parents have had to do with their kids that has been the better for them, that may have hurt the kids or made the kids think, what the hell's wrong with my parents and can I trust them? But it's just like, it's just life, actually. It's just how it is.
It's not like you made him take violin lessons.
No. So he's definitely doing a lot better now. And so he'll be going to school by tomorrow. Okay. And yeah. So thank you again to people for sort of asking or chiming in.
There were a lot of great reactions to that.
I know.
So, yeah. Okay. Yeah, now we do a smooth transition to the main topic.
To wars. Exactly. And from there, we move to the Sahel. Yeah. And what made, I know you've wanted to talk. I mean, I think if we had our way, you know, half of our episodes would probably be about Africa historically and currently. Yeah.
It's very hard to, information is hard to get, and you have to resort it because it comes to you in strange packages. And the reason that I particularly wanted to do the Sahel right now is that because there's a show there just about every week. But right now, there was a really odd article, odd in a useful way. The headline was, "We are not winning counter-terror war in Sahel, U.S. military leader in Africa says." Mm-hmm. And the subhead is significantly, "Pentagon makes cuts in Africa." And here's the key paragraph. "Major General Marcus Hicks, U.S. military special operations commander in Africa, said that he doesn't want us to decrease U.S. Troop levels there. And the reason he has to say that is the Pentagon has ordered a 10% cut in U.S. defense personnel in Africa, effective over the next few years. The shift supported the administration's new focus away from counterterrorism towards strategic competition with China and Russia. And the first U.S. military cuts on the continent pulled between 100 to 200 U.S. personnel from West Africa." So there are a lot of things here that have to be taken in balance. First, the claim, we are not winning in the Sahel. Let's just hold that in abeyance, as Walt Whitman would say, for the moment. Because when you're talking about this kind of long-term, cheap, dangerous, and dirty war, it's very hard to define winning. May not even be possible. Maybe more of a holding action. But the other thing that comes out when you see this paragraph is that, like a lot of U.S. defense information anywhere, it's not like Russian defense information is more moral and honest, or Chinese defense information or British defense information or whatever. There's always a funding angle to it. And the reason that you get that scary headline, "We are not winning," which, you know, to the average consumer of news back home is like, "Oh my God, we're not winning. Does that mean we're losing?" is that there's a 10% cut in this guy's budget. Mm-hmm. This is Major General Marcus Hicks. His career is riding on this. And even though he's already made his career, you don't make major general and then, you know, worry about not having made it in the army. But for some reason, I don't understand, people at the top are never happy, and that's maybe how they got to the top. Yeah. I don't know. But to someone like that, getting your budget cut 10% is a deep humiliation. So he has to switch from the normal Pentagon mode of everything is fine, just like they kept in Iraq, I remember. No, everything's fine. We're looking up. We're doing our job. You have to switch modes to, oh, big trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, are we losing Idaho to the Russians? That kind of thing. And so the question is, what is going on in the Sahel?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I mean, to get those budgets, it's sort of like you have to show, you see this over and over, you have to show that both you're successful and that, however, there's such a huge danger that you need more money, not less money. And so it's like, but the world and everything around is getting more dangerous, but we're eking it out through, you know, elbow grease and good old ingenuity and trillions of dollars. We're still eking it out. And, you know, if you dare cut this in the middle of our success, we're on the verge of a breakthrough. How dare you? Yeah, I mean, you see this over and over. And in fact, I saw like Carl Zah, who's been a guest on our program, of course, several times, tweeted out something by Gordon Chang, who's a China's, you know, quote unquote expert of a very familiar sort. Tim Shorrock, who's also been a guest on our show, is constantly going after Gordon Chang, who's just a arms industry shill who uses China and North Korea to pump out arms propaganda. And anyway, so Gordon Chang, I think 10 years ago, 15 years ago, put out a book saying, you know, China's on the verge of imploding. It's about to completely collapse. And now it's China is on the verge of world domination, you know? And what I was saying is like, what I see with the Russia panic industry is the same schizophrenia. Russia's always on the verge of collapsing. Putin. Putinism can't last. It's on the verge of collapsing, yet it's a greater threat now than it's ever been. And it's sort of, it's because it has to serve those two purposes that you talked about, like the two sort of propaganda purposes.
Yeah, and the fact that they make no sense when yoked together doesn't seem to bother a lot of people. Mm-mm. So it seemed like a good time to take a sort of quick look across the continent and see what's going on. And besides, these are just inherently interesting places where history is moving quickly right now. So I thought we'd take a while and do a zoom from east to west at latitude, say, 5 degrees to 15 degrees north in Africa. Doing from starting east to west, South Sudan, Central African Republic, Chad, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. There's a country that's clearly been left out of that if you're looking at a map with a latitude line in it, and that's Nigeria, which is the biggest, most important of all countries in this latitude. And that's because we're going to talk in detail about Nigeria in our next show, where we'll have a guest who will help us do that. But it's also true that you can understand Nigeria better if you have a sense of what's happening around it, because these country divides don't mean very much. There are different ethnic groups in some countries, but then there are also groups like the Hausa, for example, which overlap several of these countries. And you have to see what's going on across a band along the southern edge of the Sahara rather than just take each country as completely separate. So we'll just start east to west, see what's going on. The first of these is South Sudan, and we've talked about South Sudan before. I don't know, Mark, have we had a full South Sudan
episode? Yeah, we did mostly. Yeah, we did some. We did a chunk on South Sudan. Yes. Did you want to like even start off by giving a little bit about the geography? I mean, what does Sahel mean exactly?
Yeah. Sahel, the dry scrub forests at the southern edge of the Sahara. In fact, people talk often about the death of the Sahel, and because the Sahara is marching south, and outright desert is replacing arid land. And the Sahel is the relatively inhabitable zone south of the Sahara. And it has a very distinct culture. There are rivers in parts of the Sahel which make agriculture possible. And there are also microclimates which make agriculture possible. But there are also huge stretches where your only option is what is elegantly called pastoralism, which is herding goats or in some places herding cattle, although cattle take a lot more water. So the cattle, often there's a big dispute between cattle and agriculture because the zone where you want to pasture your cattle is also the zone where people want to grow crops. And often the ethnic groups are defined by that difference, like in the Central African Republic, the the Banda, the big riverine group, is, as they say, settled and agricultural. That is, they are farmers who live in houses. And a lot of their enemies moving down from the north are pastoralist, which, you know, they living in tents and herding goats, or in some cases cattle. So it's, there's that level going on here, and a pastoralist versus agriculture. There are a lot of binaries that you can use here, and they're an oversimplification if you see the whole thing in those terms, but they're real to in their way. Herders versus farmers, Muslim versus Christian, and in some ways, Francophone versus Anglophone, because these countries were colonized by different powers, and that still makes a difference. And they also have different relations with people to the south of them and to the north. A lot of the pastoral people have trans-Saharan links, and one of the things that's happening in this whole zone is that there's something very physics-like about it. Many of these, like the Central African Republic, were the back of beyond, like the last place you'd ever think of. But there's a lot of energy moving around to the north in the Maghrib, in northern Africa. And every time something happens, like Libya exploding, not by accident, but because the US and the UK and France wanted it to explode, that there's a reverberation in a very physics-y way down across the Sahara. And one of the things that's going on in the places we'll talk about today is the reverberation, as it were, of trained fighters and high-tech weapons from the north down into some of the sleepiest places in the world.
Yeah, I'm looking at, I'm looking at one of the maps you have here in the notes, and it says, you know, it's the Sahel map. And on the very western left side is the country of Mauritania. And my apologies to Mauritania, but I can never look at that name without thinking of that Jamie Kirchick article, Hail Mauritania.
Hail Mauritania, bastion of democracy.
Yeah. That is... Yeah, it's one for the history books.
I think we had at Exile, we had a tournament for dumbest neocon ever.
Yes.
And Kirchick may have won, if I recall correctly, with his article, Hail Mauritania.
He deserves at least a posthumous post-exile prize for that, you know.
He's doing his best to be the stupidest neocon out there, and it's a tough competition.
It is tough.
I think it seems almost superfluous to say this, Jamie has just gone from strength to strength. I don't know much, but I see his name around now and then, and you know, run like hell when I see it. But I gather he wrote something about his wonderful career at Yale, about being a little right-wing dirty trickster and what sort of Brideshead Revisited for evil dweebs. And what a good time he had there.
That's good. Yeah, he doesn't seem to be... He kind of tried to get it going again. I don't know. He doesn't seem to have... It's not like Max Boot, who has been constantly rebooting his career for, you know, and just going up and up no matter how insane and absurd he is. But I think it's just a matter of output. Some reason, Kirchick was pushing the Russia panic. That seemed to be his thing for a while, but he didn't know what the hell he was talking about, even by neocon standards. And just, I don't know, it doesn't seem to have had his heart in it. Whatever heart there is there. But don't count them out. I mean, that's one thing. There are not a lot of people willing to carry that water. And so those services will always be in need. And it's just a matter of whether they want to bank some more money or not. Yeah. Anyway, back to the Sahel.
All right. Well, again, we're starting from the east. We're going to leave Ethiopia and Eritrea out of it for the moment, because they deserve, and I swear to God they're going to get, an episode of their own.
Well, we've done some on them, but we should do more. I agree.
Yeah. So we'll start with South Sudan. And as most people probably know, this is a country that didn't exist until recently. It was part of Sudan, which was the biggest country in Africa. I'm pretty sure it's the biggest country, maybe second biggest, I don't know, or it was. It isn't now because after decades, and I mean decades starting in the 1950s, of bloody warfare, the kind of warfare that gets called primitive warfare or bush warfare, where it's mostly massacres and mass expulsions and starvations and death by disease. South Sudan finally became independent of the regime in Khartoum. And it was a big project for the U.S. State Department. And it seemed like a good day, because the more you studied what had been happening to the black people in South Sudan at the hands of people who did not consider themselves black in Khartoum, because these definitions are entirely utilitarian and have nothing to do with what people's skin actually looked like. I mean, if you remember the Janjaweed, this is in Darfur, a different theater of the Sudan War, but there were people from the Sudan who were chanting, "You are black, you are ugly, we are burning you alive." And, you know, if you're looking at them from a different perspective, you might find the ethnic differences or the skin color differences crazy and hard to understand. And that's because they are crazy and hard to understand, but they exist. And so it seemed like a good idea when the people of South Sudan were finally free of the Arabic-speaking people of the north who considered themselves Arab. And that didn't last very long, as is often the case in a new state. When you create a new state, obviously you're creating a new experimental field, and things are going to start bouncing around. Mostly big egos are going to start bouncing around, and ethnic hate is going to start bouncing around. And competition for scarce resources under that, but it will usually be expressed as ego and ethnic hate. Almost always when a people is in insurgency, there's a strong man, and it usually is a man, who becomes the synecdoche for the whole people. And if there are two competing ethnicities vying for power, as there are in South Sudan, each will probably have a strong man, and they will be struggling for power. In this case, it was the Dinka, probably the most powerful people of South Sudan, led by Salva Kiir, and the Nuer of the sort of a central oval in South Sudan, run by Riek Machar. So Nuer versus Dinka, and Kiir versus Machar, each being a metonymy for his people in the ancient way that, you know, the kings were not, until very recently, the king of France, the king of Hungary. It was like you were the king of the Franks, you were the king of the Hungarians, you were the spearhead of your people, basically, not a piece of land. So that's going on now, or was until very recently. 400,000 killed and wounded, and not in, you know, and we're not talking Stalingrad, we're not talking Gettysburg, we're talking massacre, sudden raids, people driven out into the bush to die of disease and thirst. 4 million displaced, slightly under 2 million inside the country, more than 2 million fleeing to Uganda and Sudan. And this is one of the great ironies, which they're probably enjoying in Khartoum, that after they grudgingly gave South Sudan its independence under U.S. pressure, more than 2 million South Sudanese have had to flee back to what is now a smaller Sudan, because in that part of Sudan, anyway, there isn't open warfare. So that has to be bitter for the South Sudanese and a gloat point for people in Khartoum. So things are looking very bad there. But in a way, what's going on in South Sudan is a little different from what we're seeing elsewhere, because this is not a matter of North versus South, or Muslim versus Christian, or herder versus farmer. All the groups involved here are either Christian or animist. And again, we're not talking about theology, we're talking about sectarianism, which is a wholly different thing. They are all herders, rather predominantly herders, rather than farmers. And none of them have a strong cross-Saharan link. In fact, the cattle culture of South Sudan is really extraordinary. There's a reason that Kiir, one of the leaders here, wears a cowboy hat. I wrote an article about this long ago. Mm-hmm. The cattle raid is one of the oldest forms of warfare in human history. And a lot of the ethnic fighting in South Sudan is about, are they trying to steal our cattle? And they usually are, because if you can steal someone's cattle, you do steal them. For example, in Irish literature, the great epic, and I kind of like this about the Irish, it's not about someone stealing Helen of Troy, it's about someone stealing cattle. And it's called the Toyne, which is usually translated the cattle raid of Cooley. And it's people of different clan groups fighting over a stolen cattle herd, and particularly a great bull that's been stolen. Because I'm not claiming to be the guy from Dynasty here, but even I know that if you're a cattle rancher, it's your stud bull that, you know, controls what herds you can make. I suppose it's mathematical, because, you know, a cow can only produce a certain number of calves, but a good stud bull can produce a huge number of calves.
Right.
So this is a very bloody war. It's one of the worst in the Sahel area, but it's also on its own terms. It's not at all like what we'll see in the rest of these countries. So there is at any rate a peace agreement now, and you know it's difficult not to be cynical about peace agreements in a war like this, because there's always, I mean, think about being a cattle raiding culture. It really helps, I think, to think about people far away as human beings. Like, suppose you're 16 years old and cattle raiding is a rite of passage where you come from. And somebody tells you that there's a treaty somewhere in the capital by people who are already rich and already have everything in the world, but you don't.
Yeah.
And it's like they want you to stop the succession of generations just because they made a deal somewhere that you don't even understand or know anything about it. What's most important to you, if you can remember being 16, is becoming the hero of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, it means you know that if you go in there at dawn, you can get their cattle back before they grab you or shoot you. It's just that these things are a little more bloody when everybody has an AK, which everybody does.
So this peace agreement, it has Machar is going to be one of five vice presidents, which kind of says to me that his side did not fare out too well in this.
That's exactly what I thought. Yes. Yeah. I think they lost, because one of five vice presidents is like one of those old Madison Avenue jokes, like, you know, I'm a vice president, I deliver the coffee. yeah, that's not much. Yeah, yeah. That's exactly what I thought. Same reaction, yeah.
The killing has gone, the level of killing, and or at least the pace of it, of the, I don't even know how much of it was killing. Some of it was killing, but a lot of it was, as you said, driving people into areas where they were going to die of disease and malnutrition. But all of that seems to have pulled back somewhat, right? I mean, we don't, yeah. Or do we just not hear about it for some?
As far as I know, it's pulled back.
Okay.
But it's, you know, again, these are chronic wars.
Yeah.
These are not, I think the idea of Gettysburg and Stalingrad, you know, you just got to wipe it out.
Mm-hmm.
It does not apply. So yeah, definitely things seem to be down at the moment, but down, but not out is usually the case.
Right.
So we'll see. And anyway, so yeah, we have a unique little anchor on the team right tackle, the east side of the line here. And then we move westward to a really, really interesting and at the moment pretty sad country, the Central African Republic.
By the way, real quickly, we did do an episode in part about South Sudan. That was episode 42, and that was 3 whole years ago.
So and there's also a Warnered article called Mo Cattle, Mo Problems about South Sudan, where I actually discussed that Irish epic about cattle raiding. Cattle raiding from Ireland to India is one of the most important things in history, and especially military history. It's surprising that it isn't more emphasized in most courses that I've seen.
Yeah, it is. I guess it doesn't conform to at least a modern notion of glory in warfare.
No.
I mean, we do, one of our episodes with Carl Zahr, we talked about how some of the ancient or more older Chinese empire wars had to do with horse raiding, if I remember right, you know. And I think that sounds more, I don't know why that's the case, but it sounds more glorious than cattle raiding, which seems to me obvious that wars would be about cattle raiding. I mean, that's
I think
food and
a lot of cultures worship horses, but those cultures also worship cattle. I don't claim to know about this. It's it's an interesting thing, though. There are probably cultures that worship horses, but not cattle. I think a lot of Arab cultures worship horses, but not cattle. And then to go back to ancient Ireland, they worship, as far as I know, both horses and cattle. Like, there is at least a legend that Irish kings would mate with mares once a year. just once. And they'd had a little...
Very sensible.
Yeah. they were young. They were experimenting. Who knows?
Mare curious.
they were also... very much cattle worshippers, and cattle worship still goes on far south of here in Africa. I remember some Maasai text in which somebody gets a letter from Maasai land saying cattle and people are in a good mood, and that's how they see things. You know, first you check that the livestock is okay. Oh, George, not the livestock, and then you make sure the people are okay. So we move west to a really different situation. And this is where we see the Sahel template much more typically. And this is the Central African Republic. It's a country that's pretty hard to describe. It's south of Chad, west of Sudan, north of Congo, and east of Cameroon. That's the best I can do. Yeah, the river now, and I've been trying to check the river maps for this, the big river that defines the borders of South Sudan, that divides it from the Congo, is Ubangi now. I think it was called something else when the French ruled, which is one of the problems trying to figure out what's going on here. But what you have here that makes this very typical is a relatively fertile river valley right in the center of the country. And in most cases, whether you're in Burma, Myanmar, or Central African Republic, the ethnic group that controls the main river valley is usually going to dominate. And in this case, that's the Banda. And the Banda are one of those template settled agricultural ethnic groups. So they live in houses, they farm with irrigated crops along the river valleys. that made them particularly amenable to colonial influence. So they became, and it's a sort of mixed fate, they became the French occupiers' preferred ethnic group. That also made them less warlike, somewhat like they say about the Romanized Britons, that, you know, they weren't ready when the Anglo-Saxons came by. And in this case, what's happened recently is that the Banda are part of the settled, and in this case, this overlaps with Christian riverine peoples who make up more than half of the population. Another third of the population still holds with the old beliefs, the so-called animist beliefs. And only 15% of the country is Muslim. So, but there is now more energy, more warlike energy in the north here than among the riverine settled people. It would have been the other way around, say, a century ago, and it would have seemed like a good thing to bet on converting to the French religion and converting to the French language. But it doesn't seem like so much of a good bet now, because weapons and a kind of cultural energy are flowing down from the north, being pushed that way simply by the pressure of war in North Africa. So in the past 2 years, a coalition of mostly Muslim militias called Seleka, which just means coalition, took over Central African Republic. That generated a counter militia known as Anti-Balaka, which means something like against the gunman, among the settled riverine Christian farming populations. And what's happened now is it was only with French military intervention that the country was divided at all. Because otherwise, the Seleka, much better armed, much better at warfare, better organized, would have controlled the whole country indefinitely. At the moment, we're dealing with a divided country, and nobody is quite sure how to divide it, because, again, this is just a chunk of Africa that was left between other European possessions. It wasn't the chunk anybody particularly wanted, in fact. So how you divide it up now, well, people are coming up with different ways of dividing it. One group has decided that it's going to be based on Fulani ethnicity, and it wants to claim part of this sort of it's hard to describe this place in geometric terms, the northern triangle of the Central African Republic. But at the moment, we're talking a country that's been divided into little warlord groups. And when this happens, you're no longer talking about, and this is something that often isn't clear from the news reports, you're not talking about Muslim versus Christian, farmer versus herder, left-handed versus right-handed, whatever. You're talking about somebody who used to herd goats or farm sweet potatoes is now a warlord, and he's not going to give that up. Mm-hmm. And his men aren't going to give that up because they like it. It's a situation that's good for young, mean guys with guns and bad for everybody else. But if you're a young, mean guy with a gun, then almost by definition, you don't particularly care about anybody else. So it's very hard to come back from a situation like that. And there are 14 armed groups that we know of operating there now. Each one has spawned a Napoleonic ego. Just you know, you have to imagine it that way, a little Bonaparte running his glory through his head. It's a scary world to inhabit.
Yeah.
So there's a peace deal, but it's hard to imagine that it will stick, because basically what we're dealing with is this was a place that used to be run by a colonial power. The colonial power left without paying much attention. I mean, France wants to own these places, but it doesn't really want to invest in them very much. On the contrary, wants to take money out of them. So it was left pretty much defenseless, and people who had taken the pledge, basically converting to a conqueror's religion, is like saying, "I believe you, people." You know, it's not about whether some priest explained the doctrine of transubstantiation to you in a convincing way. It never is, whether you're in France or anywhere else. It's a matter of, I will adopt this identity because I think it will help. And then suddenly they decide to leave for reasons that will never be clear, probably aren't even clear back in France. And you're in trouble.
I have a kind of a personal story, a link to Central African Republic. It was 2004. It was after I'd come back to Russia, after I'd spent a few months in the U.S. writing, going postal. I came back. It was the summertime. It was right around the time that Paul Klebnikov, the American editor of Forbes, was killed in Moscow. He was assassinated. And we needed to fill some space in the exile. This is always, you know, you can already tell something bad's going to happen. We need to fill some space at production time when we were putting the paper to bed. And there was a big story right then. It was a big scandal that somehow some right-wing American media like Town Hall and some of these were apparently conned into publishing stories that Putin's envoy to... So Putin at some point had set up, like, they had divided Russia into kind of seven regions, almost sort of like an old czarist way of seven kind of like military districts, and then he'd have his own plenipotentiary, you know, viceroy reporting right back to the Kremlin, so that he could kind of centralize control. And his viceroy or whatever for the Volga region was Sergei Kiryenko. Kiryenko was a prime minister under Yeltsin, a young reformer, pro-Western, or at least he used to be considered that. Anyway, some of his, I imagine what happened is some of his local enemies had somehow planted something that Kiryenko had written to like Colin Powell and some other people asking for a green card, promising to invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in the U.S. if he can get a green card in return. And then this apparently created problems for Kiryenko, and it created some problems for U.S. State Department. And it was a big scandal, very like literally on that day of production. So I thought, why don't we take responsibility for that at the exile? Here's a good idea, you know. So we published something in the exile as if, but we did it in a very jokey way. It was like it took a photo of me putting a piece of paper in a fax that, you know, had big stupid lettering on it, pretending like we were the ones behind it, because we had actually done a lot of pretty successful pranks. And but the whole joke was, of course, we didn't do that. But the meta joke turned out to be everyone absolutely believed that we were the ones behind it. So in the days that followed, suddenly all the Russian press and the American press started saying it was Mark Ames and the exile that was behind that. And then Henry Bonilla, who was a Republican congressman, I think from the San Antonio area in Texas. And he was pretty powerful at the time, real sleazeball. He was sort of briefly, Bush and Rove thought this is going to be the guy who's going to bring in the Latino vote for the Republicans. They kind of built him up in this brief period. And he cashed in his capital by trying to get me killed. So he wrote an official letter, you know, from Congress to demand, you know, through the State Department, to demand that the U.S. Embassy contact the Russian Ministry of the Interior to have me arrested.
Wow.
And I thought...
I think I remember that.
Yeah.
And he wasn't exactly repentant, was he?
No. And I thought, this can't be real. So I checked out, first of all, with some people I knew in the State Department, and found out from somebody who worked, I think, in the Polish embassy, and said, yes, we all got this official letter, and everyone is basically ignoring it, but, you know, but it's real and it's there. And
whom it may concern.
Yes. Yes. This is insane. I mean, the State Department was just putting out these, you know, was really just starting to turn on the heat on Putin and the way he was cracking down and hurting reporters and killing reporters, because, you know, after Putin opposed the U.S. invasion of Iraq and then took down Yukos, the oil company. He started becoming an enemy at this time. And so this just cannot be real. So I called up Tom Lantos' office, and because I was trying to get in touch with Bonilla's people, and I did call Tom. He's not from,
he was your congressman.
He wasn't, but he was nearby, and he was a big deal then, and he was a big human rights kind of liberal interventionist guy from San Mateo. And some people that I spoke to recommended contacting him because he had power. I mean, I was genuinely nervous. Like, this is completely insane. This is really powerful people trying to have me arrested for faking a prank, you know? So the Lantos people said, yeah, this is crazy, and we'll try to talk to them. You know, we know some people there. And then they gave me a way to contact one of Bonilla's top aides. And at this time, as this was going on, because I started writing about it, an EU diplomat who was in Moscow, was kind of a fan of the exile, had just, for whatever reason, I think this EU diplomat was either French or Luxembourgian or Belgian, had just moved to Bangui in the Central African Republic, and wrote me and said, if you need to get away for a while and you want to do something wild, you know, I can put you up here, and, you know, it would maybe even make a good story for you. And I never found out exactly who that person was. I assume they were real.
They did it anonymously?
Yeah, they did sort of anonymously, but if we had moved to the next level, they were going to say their name. As I recall, that's how it was done, yeah. I mean, or they didn't want to do it through electronic, transmission, and so they were supposed to first look into plane tickets, and it turned out they were like $2,000 or $3,000. It was too expensive.
Yeah, to get to places like that, yeah. I mean, that's one reason I rationalize not going there for the show. It's like they're the most expensive places in the world.
Exactly. So unfortunately, it would have made a good story, or I would have mysteriously died there. I don't know, but I didn't wind up going.
You might have become the first refugee to go to the Central African Republic.
Exactly. That was the story I was kind of trying to put together. So anyway, I wound up calling Henry Bonilla's office. Wound up speaking to the spokesperson, this woman, and God, she was rude and smug. And she said, you know, you shouldn't have played this prank. And I said, well, you don't understand. The joke was that we didn't do the prank. That was the whole joke. And I kind of tried to explain how that worked and how our paper does, you know, pranks. And I said, but on top of everything else, this is a country that's killing journalists. And you're trying to have an American journalist killed by a foreign country or arrested by a foreign country that we deem violators of human rights. Like, what the hell is wrong with you? And she said to me, well, this should teach you a lesson and all future pranksters. I'm not joking. Like, this is how she talked to me.
When the thing about Trump is that he says what a lot of people in America have thought for decades, and that I know from my own ears is what they've been saying for decades, which is the press is the enemy of the people. So a lot of people in the U.S. would have been delighted to see that happen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For a lot of people in Moscow, in the Western press corps in particular, Kathy Lally, you know, would have been very happy to see this. So, yeah. So anyway, I wasn't killed. It calmed down. No one arrested me. I tried to make as much kind of public hay out of it as I could. And, you know, it did sort of fizzle, but man, it just shocked the hell out of me. It wound up becoming a story.
You lost your chance to see the CAR.
Yeah, I did. But I did get the chance to see Bonilla voted out of office and run out of town in the next election. Yeah.
Wow. He sounds like someone who would be in there for life. I'm surprised and pleased that he was outed.
Yeah, no, he's a sleazeball. His local paper even asked him about this and had him comment on it. And, you know, he confirmed that it was happening, that he did make this request, wanted to teach.
It sounds like those are the people who send their 13-year-old kids to jail to teach them a lesson.
Yeah.
And the kid comes back, well, damaged for life, to put it mildly. Yeah. But no, they taught him a lesson.
Anyway, that's my Bangui story, my almost Bangui story. Yeah.
All right. And now we move westward. To Chad, one of the bigger countries here, one of the more powerful of the Sahel countries, which is not to say that it's of Manhattan, but it has a surprisingly impressive military history, for one thing. I mean, Chad the Chadian army or militias were the first military force to demonstrate that Gaddafi, though he bought an awful lot of expensive weaponry, had not really produced an army that was worth worrying about. I'll get to that in a bit. So Chad, again, is something like the classic template we see here. There's a Muslim north and a Christian slash animist south. In this case, unlike the CAR, the majority is Muslim, at least 55%, perhaps 40% Christian in the south. And to some extent, that tracks with herders in the north versus farmers in the south. So there is this pattern that you see in a lot of these places, all these things lining up together, because that's generally how things happen. We've been trained to think of religious identification as a personal choice. It is not. It has never been. It has always been a part of ethnic identity. That's why you can talk about sectarianism without belief. In fact, sectarianism usually goes without belief. So Chad was another part of French West Africa, one of the more dire parts of the world. And again, very typically, it got its independence in 1960. And there was a lot of fanfare about that. But the French, again, fairly typically, had not done much to prepare the country for that. And for a while, this is what's interesting. For a while, you can see their riverine southern Christian client ethnic groups dominating. And there was a leader in Chad early on who made himself, Tambo Baye, who made himself dictator more or less, and saw the struggle not as between Muslim and Christian, but between native beliefs or animism, which he championed, and an alien imposition, Christianity. So he saw himself as pro-animist, anti-Christian. But this was only because he saw the part of the country that mattered as being the South, where those were the beliefs in competition. It just completely ignored the Muslim North, even though they were actually the majority. And so he went around renaming places that used to be French names, like the capital was Fort-Lamy, and he named it N'Djamena. And he kicked out missionaries. Everyone was required to undergo traditional initiation rites. The interesting thing is, though, there are 200 ethnic groups in Chad, and these were the initiation rites of his group, and they didn't sit well with any of the other groups. His group was the Sara people, and so what you had, and you see this a lot in different doomed countries, especially doomed countries, is there's a struggle within a group that sees itself as divided without even noticing that there's a much bigger division waiting out there for it. Like, this is that struggle within Christian animist circles, and the whole majority of the country, the whole Muslim North, is excluded from this. Well, that's going to change eventually. And it did. It changed around our year, the hinge year, 1979, the military rebelled, the southern hegemony was over. And that might have gone relatively well, except that the CIA decided to, and the French, there's a lot of CIA-French cooperation here.
Yes.
And it's pretty much like having Satan himself in terms of pure evil results. A Reagan hero named Essene Abra became president of Chad with the help of the U.S. and France. And why? You always find the same reasons. Because he was anti-Gaddafi. And how do we know? Because he told us so when he asked a bunch of money and weapons. Really, I mean, seriously, Mark, we see this over and over again. If you were willing to say you were going to help topple Gaddafi. Well, if you were a psycho jihadi in England, you would get MI5 and 6 help no end, and then you could have your son blow up a bunch of tweeners coming out of an Ariana Grande concert.
You see this again also in Ukraine, this Azov battalion and various neo-Nazi battalions. They're getting literally trained and given weapons by the U.S. and NATO. And some of these groups, especially Azov, are now involved in recruiting and cross-pollinating with the white nationalist groups in this country, including one of the groups that was involved in the Charlottesville, the protests and the violence and the killing. Like, it's just the blowback is sort of like, well, that's another person, that's another agency's problem, or, you know, that's an acceptable, an acceptable loss.
And we've got our heads down. We're dealing with the problem right now. You're talking about pie in the sky 5 years from today. And, you know, and it also partakes of that filthy adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. If anybody ever says that to you, don't even argue, just slap them.
Yeah.
Slap them hard. So the U.S. and France installed this guy, Abré, who was a monster. He specialized in mass rape, and the first people he subjected to mass rape and mass killing were the Sara, the ethnic group of the previous leader, entirely with CIA cooperation. He killed perhaps 40,000 people, nobody's sure, tortured another 200,000, and was finally overthrown by Zagawa, a big Sahel tribe, Idriss Deby, in 1990. There's no doubt that the U.S. knew what was going on there. I mean, even a U.S. Official said the CIA was what installed Abré, and it's impossible that they didn't know about the tortures. There was a torture center in the capital called the swimming pool, because they just took over a big old public swimming pool, and I guess it was easy to mop up the blood, you know, that kind of it was horrible stuff. So as of now,
God, every corner of the, I'm sorry, because you think about the Reagan years and, you know, knowing about murders and knowing about genocide and all this, but you really think about Central America, where this was going on, just rivers of blood. And here they were, even in Chad. So
I'd remind me of El Salvador too. You're right. Yeah. I mean, it's just that casual sentencing of an entire people to hell on earth in the pursuit of some ridiculous crusade against a Soviet Union that was a few years from death.
And Gaddafi, I mean, talk about paper tigers. I don't know, paper, I mean, not even a tiger, like a paper, I don't know, just cat.
I mean, like, I was going to leave you
paper tomcat. I know. All right, paper weasel. Paper weasel.
Yeah, I guess there was a time when Gaddafi was a pretty effective weasel, but even then he mainly used it against Libyan dissidents.
Yes.
It wasn't like he was.
And even for that, he pretty much had to hire American CIA mercenaries.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So, just a lot to go out on. The point here is Chad is actually fairly stable compared to a lot of these countries. There is not quite the same level of open ethnic or sectarian warfare. But it's worth remembering the Abré episode. He was finally put on trial in Senegal, I think in 2013, after living peacefully there for more than 20 years. And I think he's finally in jail, but he's in his 70s, and he managed to live most of his life outside jail. And a former U.S. official said, quote, Abré was a remarkably able man with a brilliant sense of how to play the outside world. That is, he made us believe his purpose in life was to go after Gaddafi, and that he only needed this money and these weapons to be an anti-Gaddafi fighter. And the quote goes on, He was also a bloodthirsty tyrant and torturer. It is fair to say we knew who and what he was and chose to turn a blind eye. But anyway.
In other words, we're not guilty. You know, we just turned a blind eye. Is there a crime against turning a blind eye? Is there a statute against that? I don't think so. You know, we turned it. We had a blind eye and we turned it. It's pretty horrible.
And now here is where we would normally talk about Nigeria, but Nigeria is too big a topic to really bring in here. We're going to use a lot of time just covering these smaller countries around it. This, again, we're dealing with a kind of regional physics, and Nigeria has the mass of Jupiter in this system.
Can I just briefly bring us back a little bit here? I just wanted to ask you, because I say this is in your notes, and so I just wanted to ask you real quickly again about going back to the Central African Republic before we move westward again.
Yeah.
Because at the very end here, I mean, I've noticed this too, that Russia is kind of moving in, because there are important minerals there, I'm imagining, in Central African Republic. And so there's business to be done there. And the Russians are they seem to be kind of moving into, you know, wherever there's a vacuum largely created by the West, where it goes in and kind of creates chaos and then sort of figures, well, we can sort it out later or something, and that provides a kind of opportunity. Anyway, so the Russians are kind of moving in there as they are in Libya and so they support the government of Touadera, right? He said his personal guard is largely from this Wagner group.
Probably explain what Wagner group
is. So Wagner group is Prigozhin. It's Putin's chef, because he also runs. I mean, the guy has his hand in a lot of pies, you could say. He's like one of these very late Putin era. I think he's a billionaire, oligarch types. He's in everything from food catering to the Kremlin and runs some restaurants to running the famous troll factory that everyone's been making careers out of writing about as if they broke the story. The famous troll factory that, you know, Mueller indicted for allegedly interfering in the U.S. elections. And he founded the Wagner Group, which is... this is the thing that I don't quite get. I mean, it's not like Russians didn't have private security forces all throughout the 90s and 2000s. There's something a bit different about this, I guess, in the way that they're kind of much more of an arm of Russian kind of paramilitary geopolitical power. Because I think they were used in Syria to some extent. I mean, it doesn't seem like the use of mercenaries, Russian mercenaries and Wagner's, anywhere near the level of the U.S. use of mercenaries.
But you're talking about the way the U.S. uses or used Blackwater or XE,
Blackwater,
but on a smaller scale.
Yeah, exactly. Or DynCorp or all the other ones. For some reason, though, they're called contractors. We call Blackwater contractors and Wagner Group mercenaries, and it's obviously because Russians are evil. But what isn't kind of interesting is there was this was kind of a big deal last year, 2018, in the summer. So there were some pretty well-known and respected Russian journalists, investigative, critical of Kremlin journalists, and I think Khodorkovsky, the oligarch who was freed from jail, started funding another investigative journalism sort of project. And that funded these three Russians to go, like a documentary crew, to go and sort of do a piece on Russian involvement in the Central African Republic and the Wagner Group. And they were killed pretty early on. And it seems like a kind of open shut case. Well, obviously Wagner must have set them up. But the more I kind of think about it, in fact, I think an aid worker, a Canadian or somebody, was recently killed in the CAR. The more I think I'm not sure Wagner would do that unless they had something that was so deadly to Wagner. It seems kind of a bit crazy. I may be wrong. I don't know. I initially assumed, oh, that must be Wagner using somebody. But we are talking about a country in a very chaotic country with a lot of
warlords. Yeah, it's very easy to die there.
It's easy to die, exactly. And, you know, it could have been just people thought there's some valuable equipment to steal, and that's that. Like, this is, you know, a rough place. I don't know. But I just, that was, so that the peace deal came, you know, so that was last year. Now the peace deal just happened last month, actually, between these different armed groups, right? So so I guess we'll wait and
just,
see.
This is 14 armed groups.
Right.
A peace deal between two or three armed groups has a chance as a rule, but
all right.
14 armed, there's too many variables.
Yeah.
In
yeah, it's probably
equation.
Like the first of 20 that are yet to come,
yeah.
peace deals. Yeah. Well, the other thing I just wanted to bring up, and then we'll get back, I'm sorry, is I saw this one graph here. It's kind of odd that half of the Christians in the Sierra are Protestant.
Yeah.
I wonder how
Well, if it was a former French possession, then my guess would be they were converted to Catholicism. And then, as is happening in Nigeria now, a lot of former Catholics are converting to evangelicalism,
right?
Because Catholicism is a dying religion. I mean, that's fairly clear. And what does it offer you? I mean, the vivid emotional life that evangelical or especially Pentecostal Protestantism offers you, where every week you have this wild drug-like experience with the presence of God. I mean, how is Mass going to compete with that?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And it's so like Pentecostalism and that kind of Protestantism, it can be adapted so much to local customs and so on in a way that Catholicism would be a lot harder to adapt it. Right?
No, in fact, if you're a Pentecostal, you glory in the fact that you're meeting in some storefront where the electricity is out. It's more proof that you were among the saints.
Right. That's a good point. Okay. All right. Sorry about that. So let's move on now from Chad to what's next? Niger or?
I guess Niger would be better. But
Which one were you going to go to?
No, Niger.
Okay.
I was thinking pronunciation. So, before we do that, I've just been reading, and I'm not going to try to cover Nigeria in general right now, but I'm reading at the moment a book called Looking for Trans Wonderland: Travels in Nigeria by a woman named Noo Saro Wiwa, Wiwa, Noo Saro Wiwa, who is the daughter of Ken Saro Wiwa, who some people might remember was a coastal Nigerian activist who was hanged for standing up for Ogoni, the rights of the Ogoni, his people in the Niger River Delta in Nigeria. So his daughter goes back to Nigeria, and she admits openly that she hates the very idea of the country because it hanged her dad, and she never liked going there as a child. And she's actually very interesting. She's a really good writer, very frank about all this. But she covers different regions of the country. And one of the places she visits is Jos, in what Nigerians call the Middle Belt. And this is where the kind of tectonic plate grinding that we're talking about between farmer and herder, Christian and Muslim, Hausa, and since Hausa are the biggest group in Nigeria, Hausa and non-Hausa starts to work. So she's describing what she heard in this town Jos in exactly the place where this grind is going on, and the local people are called the Birom. But the people coming down from the north are the Hausa. And again, the Birom are Christian farmer types. The Hausa are from the northern caliphates, very hierarchical, very Muslim, herders more than farmers. And in Nigeria, the divide was made explicit by the British colonists. The caliphates were to be left untouched. The southern people were to be converted and transformed. So it's particularly dramatic there, and we'll talk about this in detail next week. But anyway, for now, she's talking to one of the locals, and she says, The Biram are indigenous to the Jos region, but these days find themselves competing for jobs and farmland with Hausa and Fulani migrants from the north. Here in Nigeria's middle belt, the Islamic north meets the Christian south, two dissonant communities with a common need for survival. And then you get a sense, and I think it's useful that all the people involved here are Nigerian, so nobody has to be as polite as they might be if these were outsiders. Ruth, the person she's talking to, had lived in Jos for years, and her loyalties lay firmly with the Birom. "These Hausa Fulanis have taken over," she complained, highlighting the numerous Muslim-owned businesses in town. "And the Birom are working as security men," she fumed, nodding at the security guard sitting and listening on a table nearby. "The Birom youth say, we go to Kaduna, the houses are there. We come home to Hausa," as in not house, Hausa, mm-hmm. "are there. We come home to Jos and we cannot get a job here." And then you see the fear that people have, the fear of demographics. And, you know, again, this is not something generally mentioned in polite Western discourse, but this is not polite Western discourse. This is Nigerian discourse. She says, "The Hausa man can have four wives and 10 children with each wife. The Birom man has just one wife and four children. Come election time, who has the power?" And she finishes with very typical immigrant-hating talk. Mm-hmm. "These Hausas buy a plot of land with nothing but goats on it." Again, they're herders, mm-hmm. nothing but goats on it. "Then they claim 50 people live there. Oh, it boils my stomach." And Mark, when I read this, it reminded me of something you said you heard when you first went to Central Europe, right?
Like, yeah, it's the first thing I thought too. When I went to Moravia, I was in Brno, which is a city in Moravia in the southern part of the southeastern part, if I remember right, of the Czech Republic, what's now the Czech Republic. Yeah, and met my then girlfriend's aunt who still lived there. She was my girlfriend at the time. She was from Bohemia in the northern part. And this her aunt just could not stop talking about the Slovaks and what peasants they were and how uncultured they were. This is when the Slovaks were kind of agitating for their independence from Czechia. And she said, and I always remember this word, my girlfriend then translated for me. She said, "The Slovaks drink my blood. They drink my blood." And I was like, "But because they're holding sparklers in Bratislava and want free, you know, want to have their own stupid republic." Like, okay. But it meant a lot to her, that's for sure. But you're right, like this language that she quotes there, it's very much, it's like, you know, Welbeck or yeah. You know, any Tom Tancredo, I don't know. It's remarkable how common this is. This
absolutely
these xenophobia
and universal. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you get a xenophobe and they're a xenophobe. They think the same way. So, all right. Yeah. What we're leaving out here in our progress east to west is the obvious case of Boko Haram, which we're going to talk about soon. And there's just no time to talk about it now. Mm-hmm. That's northern Nigeria. It has a lot to do with what's going on in this part of the world. But it's
right, because next week we plan to talk to somebody about Nigeria's recent elections, which of course is very tied up with ethnicity and right and tribalism and so on, and of course Boko Haram. But somebody who actually helped participate in the recent elections is going to be talking to us about Nigeria. So that'll be its own separate episode.
All right. So we move on to Niger.
Yeah.
And this matches with Chad in a lot of ways. You often see them associated. It's another landlocked chunk of desert and arid land, formerly part of French West Africa, which was a pretty messed up place. And got Libya to the northeast, Chad to the east, Nigeria to the south, and Burkina Faso and Mali to the west. One of the poorest places in the world. But here you don't see so much of the 50-50 or 60-40 Muslim-Christian divide. This is a mostly Muslim country. With a huge desert north and a small sort of chunk of riverland around the Niger River, where some riverine populations that live in houses, farmland, and adopted the French religion live. But it's got the same sort of history. 1958 acquires independence, a series of coups, counter coups, and military regimes. And we're now on the seventh republic of Niger, if you like. The ruler of the country at the moment is an ethnic Hausa. The Hausa are the biggest population in all this part of West Africa. They're not in the east so much, but all the Western Sahel dominated, or at least numerically, by the Hausa. And there is not a revolution per se in Niger, but you may remember that there was a big kerfuffle about four American soldiers who were killed October 2018, patrolling in Niger, because the borders here mean very little. There was a rebel movement in Mali. This was near the border with Mali. And by the way, four Nigerian troops were killed at the same time, but you didn't hear much about them. And there was this huge fuss about how these American troops got killed. They got killed because right. They were running a light patrol that ran into a heavily armed group, and they were ambushed, and that happens. I've never quite understood why there was so much fuss about this. I think in part, I don't know, Mark, you were in America at the time. Maybe it was because nobody knew where this was.
Or yeah, that was going. That was part of it. But, you know, if I think about it even more deeply, I'm not sure how much anybody does deeply really care about this. I think it's more like it was a news story and it could be used to attack Trump. And, you know, in fact, as I recall, what came out of this were a lot of stories about how Trump didn't properly pay the proper respects to a widow or something.
So it was just point scoring.
That's my feeling about it. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. Okay, so Niger then again is relatively stable. It's dealing with, again, physics. There's a much bigger problem in Mali.
Like, you're right. You know, the fact is there was an outrage, I think, from a part of the foreign press corps, because it made them look bad because they'd never reported this story. And in fact, there's so much of this going on. And it's a reminder that the press corps, it's a reminder that we didn't know about it because the Pentagon and the State Department didn't want us to know about it. And the press does its duty and reports what they want us to know, what they want us to be outraged about, and doesn't report what they don't want us to be outraged about or know about. So it's sort of like you just embarrassed us and made fools of us by pointing out again how worthless we are as alleged watchdogs, or as, you know, Alexander Coburn once wrote, like all well-fed watchdogs, they're just sitting in their house half asleep and feeling very satisfied, you know.
Yeah.
So that's my little rant. Okay.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Because yeah. That's what surprised me at the time. Why are people pretending to care? It can't be.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we come to one of the more interesting of these countries, Burkina Faso, and this is one of the, again, a landlocked West African country, one of the most obscure places in the world, formerly known as the Republic of Upper Volta. Burkina Faso is, again, a country with a lot of dry land and a big river, and it sits atop a lot of the West African coastal states. And a lot of the worry right now is that what's going on there will affect these coastal states. And people are saying that quite bluntly, because they don't really have to worry about offending anybody in Burkina Faso. It's a place that doesn't matter. So one recent headline was, "Alarming Burkina Faso unrest threatens West African stability. Reach of extremist groups could spread to Ghana, Togo, and Benin, says U.S. military chief." And Ghana is a fairly big place. Togo and Benin, maybe not so much. But they're all more important because they're coastal trading states. And Burkina Faso is just another impoverished inland Sahel state with nothing of interest to the outer world. But there's also, you got to remember, a funding angle to these stories. The U.S. Africa Command is under threat of a 10% budget cut, which is more important than anything that happens in military terms. And therefore, you have to remind people, you know, Burkina Faso, that place you don't care about, just like Niger, that place you don't care about until you wanted to get mad. Well, it's going to affect places you might have heard of, like Ghana. You know Ghana. It's real. So what we're seeing in those terms, to the extent that that's real and not just a funding gambit, is that this is an extremely poor country. There's been a lot of violence in Libya, Algeria, to the north of the Sahara. A tremendous surplus of trained, good fighters and weapons moving down into these totally impoverished, sleepy countries. And what they're talking about here is the knock-on effect, that these things will pass through Burkina Faso, just like immigrants passing through a poor country like Macedonia, because in a sense, these are immigration matters. War used to be called the movement of the peoples, and they will actually affect the richer, more important countries itself. So we're talking about several Sahel Islamic movements operating in Burkina Faso. Nusrat al-Islam, Ansar al-Islam, and Islamic State of the Greater Sahel. And these were places that were all operating in Mali for the most part, but have now moved into Burkina Faso. Again, almost in a physics way. Like, it's a very poor, very sleepy country where if you offer people anything, you're doing more than the government is doing. And if you offer them a sense of elan and something to fight for and believe in, you're doing much more than they've ever expected. And even within Burkina Faso, one of the poorest countries in the world, there are poorer areas like the north and the east. And those, because, you know, as usual, that's along the river in the south that there's any sort of money, agriculture, settlement. So these groups coming down from the north and from the west, from Mali, are giving people something for the first time in their lives. And the state is suddenly very fragile. And people are suddenly aware that this thing they never heard of is in danger. And the Americans have organized a conference in their typical way, something called Flintlock. I don't know where they got that from. I don't know, the Andy Griffith Show or something. They're gathering as G5 Sahel, multinational American, African force set up to stop the spread of violence in the Sahel. And then they add, which has struggled to raise money or carry out operations. Mm-hmm. There's the funding. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why are we worried about Burkina Faso when we don't care about it? Because there are army officers with access to the media whose careers are now in danger. And, you know, why do we need to? Because of the ambush in Niger. So this brings us to Mali, a bigger and more important country. It has a lot of the same features we've seen before. Weird design, almost like two triangles that are jammed together at the point. The bigger triangle is in the north, and it's mostly dry, arid or desert. The southern triangle is where the Sahel begins to moisten and become farmable. And as you'd expect, the herders, the Muslims, the people with the close ties across the Sahara are in the big northern triangle. The French clients, the farmers, the Christianized peoples are in the smaller southwestern triangle. Classic difference.
It really, it's shaped like a sailboat, really, isn't it? With the,
yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing.
the big sail and the small boat down in the south. And people may remember in 2012 there was a big conflict in Mali, to the point that I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but I seem to remember Mitt Romney saying in a debate, "I'm worried about what's going on in northern Mali," and it sounded like a Naked Gun joke, but he actually said that.
I just looked it up real quickly. I had forgotten it, I have to be honest. But it says here in the Washington, the press laughed off Romney's Mali terror warning in 2012. He was mocked. And in fact, it seems to have been something, the liberals mocked him. It says, because the conservative press 3 years later said, flashback, Romney mocked for Mali alert. Whereas the New Yorker at the time writes, Mitt, Mali, and France. And I'm sure there's a lot of whimsical irony in this. Un petit note on last... How very New Yorker. I swear to God, it begins. Yeah. Un petit note on last night's foreign policy debate. Mitt Romney's mini-seminar in Mali, largely overlooked by Americans, drew notice in France.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Well, it was a French client state, and everybody understood that. And if anybody was going to do about it, it wasn't going to be anybody Mitt Romney was connected with. It was going to be France. They're actually quite possessive in an often malign way of these states. The independence they gave those states was, as they say, notional. So the insurgency of 2012 was a mixed thing. There were two big currents. Tuareg demands for independence. The Tuareg are a big people with no state. They're almost like the Fremen, one of the few peoples who can live in the open desert of Arrakis. They were hoping to get some sort of state within Mali that they could call Azawad. But they were also joined, because everyone in this part of the world is Muslim, they were also joined by Salafi, flowing down in this very physics way from the fighting in Algeria and Libya. And that coalesced into a pretty big rebellion. But the French intervened, and quite effectively. They intervened on behalf of a classic client people, the riverine, French-speaking, Christianized farmers of the South, who typically, had relied on the colonial power to protect them and were not in any position to fight on their own. The Mali army, such as it was kind of a joke. But the intervention worked. This wasn't really a very powerful insurgency. But it didn't go away. You can suppress things like that. But as long as there's this tension, people from the north, people from the south, herders, farmers, jihadis, Sufi quietists, and above all, intense poverty with no options, then, the insurgency will go on, which is why four American soldiers patrolling in Western Niger near the Mali border got themselves killed, because there's still plenty of people there who are just sort of going through a sleep cycle of the insurgency, and it will be back.
This is kind of an interesting story you have here. We wrote in your notes here the latest from Mali, as peace efforts falter, violence in central Mali spirals further out of control. And apparently the French, or everyone, had sort of believed that this one sort of radical, charismatic leader had been killed. And he's resurfaced in a video, and he hasn't been killed. Amadou Koufa.
But one thing you find with insurgencies is that insurgent leaders have to be killed 12 or 13 times.
Yeah, Syria.
Zarqawi, how many times did he have to be killed before he stayed down? Because you're always claiming the big kills, and it's often just a career move. Like, we're seeing a lot of these things are career moves, because we're dealing with military people who are trained to think in terms of we won, we lost. And again, these are chronic wars. You don't win or lose. It was like what they were trying to do to my damn molar. Like, you can tamp down the infection for a while, but until you pull the thing, and what am I doing when I come out of the metaphors there? Nuclear war? I don't know. But until you actually pull the tooth, it's eventually going to come back.
until you provide some oxycodone rather than the ibuprofen, you know, this thing's going to keep going on. Yeah. So what do you think, what's, I guess the sort of the summation of this would be, don't expect, I mean, this is just an ongoing story. There's no sort of beginning or ending.
If you want to think about it in some metaphorical way, think tectonic plates.
Yeah.
What we're seeing is the long readjustment from a period of European expansion, which came from the coast up the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
So in all these places, especially in the West, what you're seeing is riverine, Christianized client peoples who were in the ascendant pushing north against, you know, North Africa was seen as a dying place in the 19th century. The French and English often looked on those people with pity, and their populations were objectively declining very rapidly. That's all changed. The colonials decided to move back, at least from explicit occupation and military support. The North African center, the North African plate, if you like, is moving quickly now, generating a lot of war, a lot of population, a lot of cultural energy as well, and pushing south against those. And that, I think, applies to a lot of the countries we've talked about. Central African Republic, where even though the northerners are a very small part of the population, they're the trained soldiers, they're the ones with the weapons, and they're dominating. In Chad, you know, things are, and Niger, things are relatively stable. But in Mali, you see the same thing. Formerly, the French and their clients were pushing up the rivers into the Sahel and the Sahara. Now, the northerners are pushing back down, and that's happening across the board. The exception there is South Sudan, which is, but in, if you look at it in a larger sense, it's not an exception, because we dealt with South Sudan as a single country. But right. After all, this used to be Sudan.
Right.
And if you think of it as Sudan, that is Khartoum versus the South,
mm-hmm.
all the templates we've applied
right.
Fit pretty much,
right.
except for the herder, because the Southerns are extreme herders. But there was the same tension, and that resulted in an absolute break, two different states, if that can survive. There are a lot of Nigerians who want that solution, who want the North and the South to be divided on the lines that Sudan was fighting. I don't think it's going to happen, but there are a lot of people wanting it. And so we're just seeing the same processes happening right through here. The things controlling the speed and the ferocity of the action are basically how much any foreign power cares about the place. So they're, you know, wait for oil to be discovered and then see if things change in a hurry.
Right. Okay, well, that was great. I really appreciate that. I mean, it's this is a part of the world that gets very little attention, as we saw with the Niger, the killing of the four special forces, where suddenly it was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
We didn't even know that place existed, let alone, you know, that American special forces were there. But it's very, first of all, it's just incredibly interesting as hell, and it was just way too unjustly underreported, uncovered. And you know, just a quick note out, I think, to our subscribers, if you can help too. It's really hard to find somebody to talk to talk about this. I mean, the one person who's sort of reported from there that so far that we've been able to get on, Jeffrey Gettleman from the New York Times. You know, he had some great stories from there, but he had his downsides too. You know, so you know, as somebody who doesn't talk like Mr. Rogers, but who has been reporting from there, would be great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so if anybody has any suggestions, let us know, because we're still looking. We're out there, you know, constantly trying to send out feelers, but we would love to get deeper into the story of any of these countries in this region. All right, let's take a break and then come back and do a quick World of Wars. Okay, so let's take a quick look at some stories going around the news right now. We'll talk about Venezuela and the big power outage there. And I mean, I think last week or the last episode we did, John, talk about the failure of plan number one to for regime change, right? Which was sort of, they'll greet us with cakes and everybody will rise up and, you know, what can go wrong? And then nothing happened. And yep. Everybody now is pointing fingers at everybody else. And Pence is angry at Guaido, and Guaido is angry at God knows who. And then I do want to briefly talk about Ilhan Omar again. I know I don't know how much of a specifically American story this is. I don't know how much this gets around the rest of the world. I mean, we are talking about an immigrant from Somalia, and it is a kind of a semi-global issue. And I don't know. I want to just sound off on it a little bit. But first, let's talk about Venezuela. So, massive power outage in Venezuela. And immediately, little Marco Rubio, of course, who had previously tweeted images of out to Maduro himself of Gaddafi the moment that he had the bayonet shoved up his ass and he was killed by getting bayonet raped. He tweeted that out to Maduro very mockingly, like, this is what's going to happen to you. Really nasty stuff. Florida, you know, bugs should have sawed off Florida. Should have got away with it. Didn't work.
He tried.
I know. So, the first thing that comes to mind when you see this Venezuela power outage is an old CIA trick. And you know, some people, I think, were kind of theorizing, oh, this has to be CIA, and the Maduro people, I think, have already been saying they think it was a cyber attack. It was managed to turn off all the electricity, and people are already dying, people on dialysis machines. I mean, of course, we're already strangling them economically. But this is more of like a psychological warfare thing. And
didn't Pompeo also tweet something ridiculously offensive and gloating, like, no power, no water,
yes,
soon no Maduro?
Right, yes. I mean, they were very much gloating over this and gloating and kind of hyping up the idea that, see, Maduro can't even keep the lights on and this is all them. And then people, including some Maduro supporters, were saying, well, this looks like a classic case of sabotage. And then, of course, oh, the conspiracy theorists are out now, as if this would ever happen. I don't know. Does anybody read history? I mean, because I've been reading about this stuff for years. You just come across this when you research any number of different stories. You come across it. The most obvious example of CIA sabotage, specifically of electricity plants, is Cuba. I mean, the shit we did to Cuba, it's unbelievable. Leaving aside whatever you think about Castro, whether he's like this great socialist hero or a totalitarian bad guy, what the U.S. has done is, I mean, it makes Russia, in terms of bullying its neighbors, it makes Russia look like fluffy little kittens. It's just brutal what we've done there, like experiment on anything. But I did find, just for by way of example here, on top of, you know, books I've read about CIA guys and their Cuban exiles who've gone in to sabotage electricity plants, ships, sugar processing plants. I mean, everything to wreck the economy. There were stories about spreading swine flu, trying to spread swine flu in Cuba. I can't remember if that one was real or not. Like, I haven't looked deeply enough, but the electricity plants was definitely real. And here's the CIA plan. This was approved, I believe, by Kennedy in after the Cuban Missile Crisis. They realized, okay, we can't do anything overt there, so we're going to go for a full covert regime change subversion plan. And it's remarkable how little new thinking there has been since 50 years ago, you know, under Kennedy. I'm just going to read a little bit of this here. So it's dated June 8th, 1963. It's a declassified CIA proposal paper for the National Security Council. I'm going to read a few. It's called Proposed Covert Policy and Integrated Program of Action Towards Cuba. It starts off within the context of the policy assumptions, that is to say, wars and so on. An estimate of the situation in Cuba outlined above, the CIA submits a program consisting of the following interdependent courses of action. And there it's sort of, you know, getting intelligence, propaganda is very important. See exploitation and stimulation of disaffection in the Cuban military and other power centers. You're seeing this today. We're working very hard, very overtly and covertly on trying to get Venezuelan military defectors. Economic denial actions on an increased basis, that is the economic sanctions. E, general sabotage and harassment. And, the objective is to promote the fragmentation of the regime, the Castro regime, or you put in Maduro, and possibly lead to an internal coup, which would dislodge Castro, Maduro, and his entourage. And then under D, economic denial actions, I'm going to read here again from the CIA proposal or report. Overt official U.S. economic sanctions in conjunction with covert economic denial operations, such as denial of, and this is actually blacked out, is causing a marked adverse effect on the Cuban economy. For maximum impact on the Cuban economy, this effort must be coordinated with sabotage operations. And then here, I'm going to read about some sabotage and harassment operations proposed. Sabotage in this program is both an economic weapon and a stimulus to resistance, that is to say, to regime change. As an economic weapon, it is a supplement to and therefore, blacked out, must be coordinated with the economic denial effort, that is to say, sanctions. As a stimulus to resistance, there must be visible and dramatic evidence of sabotage. So sabotage should be big and make people feel that the regime is losing power, pun there. So here they give the very first proposed example of economic sabotage. A, electric power, disruption of any of the existing power grids which might be affected by damage to or destruction of the generating facilities or of the critical substations in the distribution network would significantly weaken the existing economic and social structure, particularly in view of the fact that in many areas the power now available is not adequate to meet the demands of industrial and public consumers. And this was all done. B is petroleum, oil, and lubricants. Of course, Venezuela is a petroleum-based economy, and on and on and on. And so
they even recommend, I see from your notes here, they even recommend low-tech versions, like smaller acts such as throwing chains over high-tension lines to short them out.
Yeah.
I think anyone who contends that messing with the Venezuelan power infrastructure is a conspiracy theory after that is being a little implausible. There's a point at which not accepting the possibility of a real conspiracy is just not being rational.
Well, and it's not like the Trump regime is hiding the fact that they're trying to do a regime change. I mean,
that's true.
Open
they're gloating about the power going off.
Yeah. They're just doing it in a sloppy way. This is, again, to bring up Ilhan Omar again. She had these great lines about Obama and other presidents like Obama who kill and do regime change but are very polite and soft-spoken about it. And that's really the main difference between them and Trump, who is very crude about it, crude and gloating, which is true. I mean, as John, you said in one of your better earlier observations of Obama, he's got the perfect kind of demeanor of an assassin, quiet about it. And people, a lot of people don't like that. They want to gloat in it and revel in it, and that's why they like.
That's exactly true. I mean, I read those comment sections, like I've said. You read the comment sections of some right-wing thing, and they hate the fact that Obama didn't screech for them.
Yeah.
These are, pretty, I think most Americans are pretty depressed and angry. And these are depressed, angry people, and it's important to them that someone gloat for them, and the killings.
And, in case you needed to be reminded how ridiculously hypocritical, and it's, again, not just Trump. I mean, one thing Trump does serve is he has this way of inadvertently, constantly discrediting the sort of the credentialed, ruling class and the centrist class who are all behind him on Venezuela. I mean, he's Hitler unless he bombs or tries to overthrow a country, in which case he's, George Washington. He's presidential. It's It's unbelievable. So, you know, in the hypocrisy side of the story, this came out, and this is not being reported in any of our free, intrepid press. Colombia, which is our main ally and main staging ground for the regime change in Venezuela. This came from NACLA, which is an old leftist group that focuses on Latin America work. And I'm just read you off the beginning part. The links are to Spanish language press, so they just kind of they actually wrote more about neoliberalism in Colombia. But just the first paragraph is like, what? Colombia Today. So this was just published on March 7, 2019. Colombia Today has the highest number of recorded assassinations of human rights defenders in the world. In the first 15 days of January 2019 alone, 9 social leaders were murdered. These alarming statistics make it clear that peace is, has not come to Colombia despite the historic peace accords with the FARC, which we always worried about and wondered if it's going to go that way. And I think, you know, it pretty much has. But that's just that alone. Colombia, which is our staging ground for our outrage over the human rights abuses in Venezuela, actually has the highest number of assassinations of human rights.
And as you said, this is not being reported anywhere.
No, only in the Spanish language press. And actually, when you click through the articles, these are not blogs. I mean, these are pretty major, El Tiempo in Colombia.
Okay.
And this is not like some, you know, Joe Schmo guy, like we put this in his blog. This big articles, actually big reported articles from the Colombian press. It's just depressing. I know what is so freaking depressing is how full of shit the resistance is. And I don't know, maybe this is the time to bring up a little bit Ilhan Omar and how.
Yes.
How I had a few things I wanted to say. So Ilhan Omar, of course, criticized the power, but it was in a very, it's really weird. So she was speaking at some, at a bookstore, I think, Prose and Poetry, or is it a sort of diner bookstore, I think, where they have a lot of speaking events in Washington, D.C. And offhandedly said something that everybody knows and a lot of people say. But it's her who said it, and that's the problem for a lot of reasons, which is the power of the Israeli lobby. And, you know, first of all, everybody knows this. It's talked about a lot. I mean, and even the ability to talk about this openly, we're still not at a place where you can completely talk about it openly and not worry about having your career destroyed. But we've moved a lot further in the last 10 years towards being able to talk about it openly than 10 years ago. It was a career killer.
Anyway, we should mention for people who may not be part of the American audience that Ilhan Omar is a Somali-American hijab-wearing congressperson, and that's part of where the outrage came from.
Right. And even more specific, if she was a centrist or one of those, or somehow like a Republican lackey, you know, or something. I don't think, even if she said something about Israel, people might have been a little upset. The real problem is that she's part of this new group of more insurgent populist leftists on a whole range of policies that is, you know, she really is anti-interventionist and she is for real redistributive.
Which I've seen Democratic boredom leaders or whatever they're called described as young people acting like young people, and now they have to stop acting like young people.
And
we've been doing such a, that's the part that gets me, because we've done such a great job. You will have noticed we, your centrist leaders, lost everything.
Yep.
And therefore we should be retained in command.
Yeah. Well, I think they lost everything because we don't appreciate them enough. And it's all our, you know, it's our doing. It's incredible, and I don't ever expect them to really wake up to any of this. You just expect them to find new angles. And what happened here, as far as I'm concerned, is, you know, some people that probably even the Nancy Pelosi's and Chuck Schumer's aren't, maybe, let's leave Schumer's side, maybe Pelosi's types aren't normally in with, like, the real hard right AIPAC crowd quite so much. I may be wrong on this, but not totally deep in with them, or certainly the AIPAC people may not totally love Pelosi, let's say. But for a lot of Democrats from sort of the liberal and centrist wings who really hate all the attention that Ilhan Omar and AOC and Bernie Sanders and all these people are getting, for them, this was an opportunity to discipline them, to cut them down to size.
Oh, I see. Like, oh, good. She crossed the line. Now we got
yes,
her.
Yes, now we got her on something. And they all came together. And this is it. So it was like a coalition of horribleness. You know, you had, basically the evangelical right, which is desperate to do everything for Israel so that, you know, the day may come where all the Jews are bundled together there and killed.
Israel, the sacred kindling.
Yes, yes. And then you have, then you have sort of the right wing pro-Israel Jewish lobby as well. But, you know, a lot of younger generation, this is the thing I don't think a lot of people get. People under 40, certainly in this country, Jews under 40 in this country, you see this in polls, they're range from kind of apathetic, out of sort of morosely apathetic about Israel, to opposing or wanting to like actively more oppose Israel. They have a negative view of Israel. And certainly it's much more common now for Jews to think Israel does not equal Jewish, and it's anti-Semitic.
I have to say, as someone who understands the pull of ethnic chauvinism, I have to say, I find that very impressive. I'm not sure I'd be able to do that. And I think it's generally American Jews who are stronger in themselves who've been able to do that.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, because if you're brought up on, you're brought up on myths, well, reality myths, you know, about oppression and your whole history of oppression. And this is what makes you in any way special. I mean, probably most ethnic groups think they've been oppressed, but, you know.
Well, I just saw a poll today. 75% of Republicans think white Americans are discriminated against.
Right.
So anybody can do it.
Yeah. But this is, you know, this is drilled into you in Hebrew school and in, you know, congregations. And most movies about Jews have to do with oppression of Jews. You know, some of them aren't, but, or if it's a comedy, there'll still be some mention of the Holocaust or some oppression of Jews. So this is drilled deep into you. And there's only so long you can look at the fact that Israel is an apartheid state and it is oppressing another weak people and bullying and murdering them. Like, there's only so long you can look at that, and you either at that point go, okay, I'm just a fascist and that's it, I'm for this,
right,
and
yeah,
you can't talk to me. And there are a lot of those now.
That's where Podhoretz went, I think. It was like a decision, like, okay, if I can't do progressive except Israel, then the hell with the progressive part.
And, you know, Bibi Netanyahu just came out today and said openly, he'd said something to the effect of, you know, Israel's a Jewish state, and some famous TV presenter, this is all over the Israeli media, just as we were starting to record the show, said, well, wait a minute, Arabs are also citizens of Israel and they're Israelis. And he said, no, they're not. This is a country for Jews only. Yeah, so like, you know, so anyway, moving on, this sort of, you know, cell phone videotaped comments by Ilhan Omar. They were posted and put all around social media, taken out of context to make it seem like she was talking about, you know, the Zionist conspiracy to control the, like, they really blew out of proportion the words that she said. They talked about tropes. Tropes now are the big thing. All of a sudden, everyone's using this goddamn rhetoric word, tropes.
I know.
It's really pissing
us,
me off.
This is really painful. Don't do
hey,
that.
I was using tropes before you even knew what the damn word meant. God damn it, yeah.
And you're using it wrong. And which trope? Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
So, and then you started seeing a lot of, like, well-meaning, left liberal, I guess you'd call them, Jews in media saying, you know, I'm not a hardcore supporter of Israel, but these comments, or what they thought were the comments, made me uncomfortable. And here's the thing, and then people started attacking them, but I have to say, there's something to that. I think the people who really instrumentalized an edited clip of what she actually said knew that this was going to be really useful, because no matter what, and this is true with any ethnic group or any sect or gender, whatever you're going to say, it's one thing for your own to criticize what you see as your own group. And it's another thing for an outsider to do it, a goy or whatever. And then it's more unsettling than anything, this new left-wing Somali refugee wearing a hijab. I don't care. It's going to make you, it makes you uncomfortable. Like they said, it makes you uncomfortable. Yes, it does make you uncomfortable. It's a threat. Deep down, it's a threat to your sense of like, okay, I can actually handle this transition from, you know, slavish support of Israel to critical support. Like, I can manage the right speed at which this goes. But suddenly this insurgent who, no matter what, no matter how not racist you think you are, you still have deep in your head all these ideas planted through our culture and through the things you hear. And it feels threatening. You know, it does feel threatening. And you know how this is, John. I mean, Irish, it's one thing if Irish people make a nasty joke about whatever caricature about the Irish, but if you hear it from anybody else outside, and then particularly...
Well, I don't like it on Fawlty Towers.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
It's like, there are people I'll take it from, but I won't take it from John Cleese on Fawlty Towers.
Right.
And in fact, it even makes me nervous when Marky Smith does it. And that is a really complex issue because, well, it just is. But definitely not John Cleese on Fawlty Towers. So yeah, it depends because, which archetype is speaking now and how much will you allow them to speak? But the amazing thing, and I think Michael Pollack, an American Jew who's a friend of the show in a big way, said on social media that what he liked about Omar is that they pulled the trigger on her and it didn't work.
It didn't work.
That was a watershed event.
Yeah, it's really, and this is what I mean. I mean, this was really more than anything about a power play. If it was just right-wing Republicans complaining and Pelosi and all, Pelosi would just pose on the cover of Rolling Stone with Ilhan Omar. You know, then she turns around to lead this resolution to condemn her. Yeah. I mean, it's just these people are so gross, but they're holding on to their power. And so they want
to... One thing I noticed trying to talk to Americans about this sort of thing is that they will insist on moralizing every issue, even if they know in their hearts that these are issues about power. Mm-hmm. They will insist on churching it up.
Yep. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I think what they understood was this is going to make a lot of people feel uncomfortable. A lot of Jews who otherwise feel kind of excited for AOC and excited for Ilhan Omar. But, you know, with these edited comments and then the way it's being spun, you will, and they did, get a lot of people say, this makes me uncomfortable. But the reality is, things are moving, I don't know, you know, the ground is moving underneath the feet of the ruling class or the establishment, whatever you call them, you know, more than they, it's amazing, nothing is waking them up to it. Like, not 2016, you would have thought that would have, not the elections 2018, not, you know, a whole series of things. And what happened with this was they thought, okay, this is going to be our chance to really start putting these people in their place. And instead there was a huge campaign, phone calls, emails, people called in saying, this is BS. I mean, Steve King.
What I like best about that campaign, and I've been reading a bit about it, I think you know it better than I do, but what I read is that the whole African-American Democratic Caucus said, you've been so quiet about these incredibly horrible things that get said in Congress because you're a bunch of Clintonites and all you know how to do is take a punch.
Yep.
And now you're suddenly turning into Mike Tyson over this?
I know. And she's not, she's really impressive, I got to say. Like, she's not being cowed at all. She came right back and talked about Obama as a polite mass murderer. You know, I mean, good for her.
That broke another wall.
Yeah, I know. And yet a lot of people think this, and certainly where the energy is.
I've heard people say it in private. I've said it in public.
Yeah.
that Obama is the George McClellan of American 21st century politics. He's like this commander who inherited a great army in a perfect moment and would not strike.
Yeah, so I find it interesting. And then, of course, there's this other side episode, which I also enjoy, and also Michael Pollack, the Radio Warner helper and subscriber, who arranged that wonderful reading, the Iliad reading, by the way, and Radio Warner party at the KGB bar. So Eli Valley, who's a really good cartoonist and a big fan of Mad Magazine. Actually, I found this out from Michael Pollack. So he did this because Meghan McCain, John McCain's daughter, went on The View and started crying and said, as a Zionist, I find, you know, what Ilhan Omar is so hurtful and scary and, you know, and poor Israel, Israel is. And again, she's here. So here you have this blonde, rich heiress Shiksa, you know, blubbering on behalf of Israel and doing a very anti-Semitic thing, which is equating Jews with Israel, and like Jews are not Israel, and this is not within the Jewish world and within the Israeli world. This is a widely held view. Like I remember, there was this documentary not long ago. I want to say maybe it was called The Gatekeepers, and it was interviews with like five of the last leaders of Shin Bet, the Israeli intelligence agency. And I just remember one of these guys, a real killer, a great presence, you know, for a documentary and a killer and very interesting guy. And he said at one point, he said, what the hell is wrong with American Jews or Americans thinking that what happens in Israel affects them personally? This is a foreign country in a foreign world, part of the world. And it's just, it is completely irrational for American Jews to identify that. It's like Italian Americans thinking everything that goes on in Italy is as important to them as everything that goes on, you know, in America. It just, it makes no sense. It's a different world.
This is an Israeli, I didn't see that movie, yeah. I have to admit. An Israeli intelligence official saying that? Wow.
Yeah, they were being like really candid. You know, I have a feeling there's not nearly as much of that in Israel. I remember there was so much of that in 91. It was what finally helped put me, you know, it was finally put down my youthful Zionism, that, and of course the ADL spying on me with South African intelligence. But that was that, and my cousins there, and all the Israelis I met were like, what the hell do you, you know, we're all trying to get out of this country. We don't want to be like spending weekends, you know, in the slums trying, you know, chasing Palestinian kids or throwing rocks at us. Like, this country's shit. This stuff that I heard. And then when I came back 10 years later, it was like, if you said anything even slightly critical of Israel, they got really touchy about it. A lot of people. And because the country just moved very far right and very paranoid. And it's only gotten way worse since then. So I feel like some of these guys anyway who were interviewed in this, they were just kind of more older school Israelis. I don't think you'll get a lot of that today. So Eli Valley then did this cartoon of Meghan McCain. And it's a very funny and very brutal cartoon of, you know, this Shiksa with like a book, How Christians Can Understand Jews or something like this. And like, you know, a yellow
star. She's got a cross around her neck.
Yeah, she's got a cross around her neck.
She's spilling a box of you help me out here, of matzah soup mix.
Oh, yeah, 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 matzah soup mix, which is like, yeah, like Passover Seder matzah soup mix, which is, you know, pre-made for people who don't. Yeah, she's spilling that and saying, you know, poor Israel, you know, I feel I'm my own people are suffering right now because of Ilhan Omar or something to that extent. I don't have it in front of me.
And she's got a, as I recall, she's got a Star of David that she's putting out on the table, you know. Yes.
Actually, here I am looking. Okay, I just brought it up right now. Yeah, all right. The thing she said about the Holy Land, that is Ilhan Omar, that refugee girl wants to exterminate us Jews. And she's like crying with a cross around her neck. And she has a book, A Christian's Guide to Seder, Yentl. You know, The Jewish Race Explained is another book there. and then Eli Valley tweeted this out. And then Meghan McCain wrote, Eli Valley, of course, is Jewish, and Meghan McCain wrote, "This is the most anti-Semitic thing I've ever seen."
Oh, let me explain it to you.
And so Michael Pollack rightly tweeted out, well, parts of Eli Valley's first comics book, and it's all about how Mad Magazine influenced him. And he's got, like, from my point of view, I think from your point of view, from, you know, the exile and from the sort of satire that we've gone by. I mean, satire, real satire should make you uncomfortable. It should make you squirm in your seat. It should hurt. Yeah. It should make you...
That's why it's hard to do with a churchy audience. And so many more Americans are churchy than actually think they're churchy.
And I said, Daily Show, and it was great. I mean, for what they did and what some... It's as clever as it gets. But it's kind of the problem too. It got college-educated, liberal-minded people, a whole generation of them, thinking that the purpose of satire is to make you feel smug and comfortable, and that this is a zinger that's getting those dummies on the other side. And it's, for me, like, it should hurt you, I think, you know,
yes.
And it should be painful for the artist as well, the satirist. I mean, it's like. Distribute that pain all around.
And it's as easy to make fun of Alabama and Berkeley as it is to make fun of Berkeley and Alabama, and you get no points for either of those.
Yeah, and so it was kind of refreshing, I think, to see that. The whole episode was, I mean, what's good about it so far anyway, never count these ghouls out, but what's good so far is the pushback, certainly in our lifetime since like the death of the 70s, you just haven't really seen pushback like this against kind of the ruling elites and the establishment that's actually seems to work. And
it was another one of those moments. And there have been quite a lot in American popular culture in the past few years where it's like they're waiting for the vehicle to come into the IED killing zone. It's like, oh, please. And there it is right in the center, and you press the button and there's a big kaboom. And you go, and there it comes, trundling along.
Still
that is not supposed to happen. So either you go into deep denial, which I assume they will, and just huddle around each other in a smaller circle, or they'll, maybe some of them will wake up and see that people are not in the mood to have a bunch of compromisers anymore. They want some fighters.
Well, I'll tell you what I think from this, and you heard it here first, folks. I am quite sure of this, actually, because you're just starting to see this. I think in 2016, the sort of the ruling class, again, establishment, all these people, they never took Bernie that seriously in his democratic socialism. It just seems so out from left field. And it was so like, you know, well, okay, people are talking, whatever, but it's just not real. The real threat to them, because we've spent 40 years in a right-wing word narrative, it was Trump. And it's, you know, and still is Trump to them. But since, especially even kind of since the last election, and now we're already seeing the polls going into the 2020 election, where Sanders is again up top and Elizabeth Warren is running this insurgent campaign talking about some really big populist stuff like breaking up the tech companies. I think what you're going to start seeing, John, is kind of like with this Ilhan Omar episode, is that as left populist, democratic socialists, whatever you want to call them, as the threat of them taking real power, more power, real power, and actually being able to implement any policies becomes more and more real to these people, you're going to start seeing a lot of centrists and a lot of rich people who are... you know, showered themselves in glory for being anti-Trump, moving towards Trump or a right-wing, so-called right-wing populist alternative because they think that democracy now is the problem. Mm-hmm. And but they're going to go with the person or the party, whatever, that's going to protect their property. And right. I think you're going to start seeing a lot of this. You're going to see kind of liberal splitting off, kind of like what happened. I mean, I hate to compare it all to anything 20s, 30s, but, a bit like, let's say, Italy, some other places where you start seeing liberals fracture and, like, the right-wing liberals go with whoever's going to protect the property. The centrist liberals kind of get marginalized. The left liberals, a lot of them, they kind of have no choice but to sort of go with the populist left. And I think we're going to see that, and it's going to be surprising and shocking that some of the people we're going to start seeing, if the trend keeps going this way, that are going to start saying, well, they're forcing me to do this, but better Trump than Sanders, better Trump than blah, blah, blah. And that's what Howard Schultz, the billionaire CEO of Starbucks, has already basically said. I'm running, and just so you know, I'm going to get Trump elected if the Democrats dare nominate somebody that threatens my property. And I know all of my friends are going to vote for Trump too. So you have a choice. You either nominate Kamala Harris or Joe Biden or somebody we like, or you get Trump and we'll make sure of it. Yeah. Lovely folks.
And on that happy note.
Yes, on that happy note, I think it's enough. Thanks again, John. Thanks again, everybody.
Thanks,
Until next week.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.